Blog Talk Radio.
For radio as godless as our Constitution, tune in to Free Thought Radio.
We examine Supreme Court nominee Amy Coney Barrett's alarming views on church and state.
Then we'll interview Professor Christopher Cameron, the author of a new book,
Black Freethinkers, A History of African American Secularism.
Good afternoon, listeners. Free Thought Radio follows the latest UN news and brief.
This is the news and brief from the United Nations. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights Michelle Bachelet has called on governments worldwide to redouble their efforts to prevent rape and other forms of sexual violence. She also appealed for a rights-based approach to prosecution after highlighting a new law in northwest Nigeria which allows surgical castration for male rapists and the death penalty where the victim is under 14. Tempting as it may be to impose draconian punishments on those who carry out such monstrous acts, we must not allow ourselves to commit further violations, she said in a statement. The development follows numerous rapes reported around the world in recent weeks, including in Algeria, Bangladesh, India, Morocco, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Tunisia. People have rightly been outraged and are demanding justice for the victims and measures to prevent such assaults from happening again, Ms. Bachelet noted, in an appeal for greater assistance for victims, prompt criminal investigations, and prosecutions.
I share the outrage and stand in solidarity with the survivors and with those demanding justice. But I am concerned that there are also calls, and in some places laws already been adopted, bringing in cruel and inhuman punishments and the death penalty for perpetrators. The main argument being made for the death penalty is for it to deter rape, but in fact, there's no evidence that the death penalty deters crime more than other forms of punishment.
The death penalty or other measures such as surgical sterilization of perpetrators will not resolve the barriers victims of sexual violence face in accessing justice, Ms. Bachelet said. A staggering warning now from the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF. 3 billion people are unable to wash their hands properly at home, and 1 billion are at immediate risk of catching COVID-19 because they lack basic hand-washing facilities. Washing your hands with soap is key to preventing infectious diseases, not just the new coronavirus, UNICEF said on Thursday, which is Global Handwashing Day. In an appeal for urgent action to address the issue, the UN agency said that it was unacceptable that the most vulnerable communities lack the simplest of methods to protect themselves. The 1 billion people said to be at immediate risk are children and families living in informal settlements, migrant and refugee camps, or in areas of active conflict, UNICEF explained. It cited data showing that the problem is worst in least developed countries, where nearly 3 in 4 people lack basic handwashing facilities at home. In the world's poorest countries, 7 in 10 schools have nowhere for children to wash their hands with water and soap. And in sub-Saharan Africa, more than 6 in 10 people in urban areas, or 258 million people, lack access to proper handwashing. The repatriation of 18 Yemeni nationals previously held at Guantanamo Bay United States military prison should be halted as their lives could be in danger, UN-appointed rights experts said on Thursday. In an appeal to the United Arab Emirates, UAE, where the Yemeni men were resettled after their release, the independent experts cautioned that their forced return to Yemen would put their lives at risk. After more than 5 years of fighting, Yemen's armed conflict has created one of the world's worst humanitarian emergencies. The fact that non-state armed actors control parts of the country does not allow the provision nor compliance with diplomatic assurances, the experts said, adding that such assurances, where provided, do not release states from their international obligations, in particular the principle of non-refoulement. The experts also noted with concern that the men faced continuous arbitrary detention at an undisclosed location in the UAE. They were allegedly forced to sign documents agreeing to their repatriation, the experts said, or else remain indefinitely in Emirati detention without charge or trial. They also insisted that no state has the right to expel, return, or otherwise remove any individual from its territory whenever there were substantial grounds to believe that the person would be in danger of torture in the state of destination. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven. It's easy if you try.
This is getting kind of ridiculous at this point. Yo, my cat died in a global pandemic, took over my life, and I put out some music that nobody likes. So I got really sad and bored at the same time, and that's why I'm like low-key F2020. Still sad, still ain't got no money.
Hi, I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and that is the group Avenue Beat singing F2020. That's the plaintive plea of all of us. I think I'm kind of done. Can we just get to 2021?
And that's a young group of, what do they call, Generation Z or whatever they are called these days, wishing they could get out and, like all of us, live a normal and full life. I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist, and this is the October 15th, 2020 edition of Free Thought Radio. Annie Laurie and I, again, are hosting from our safe-at-home studio in Madison, Wisconsin, while Buzz Kemper, again, is engineering from Audio for the Arts. That's his recording studio down right close to the Wisconsin State Capitol.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is a 501c3 nonprofit working to educate the public, that's you, about non-theism and to keep religion out of government as our godless, secular U.S. Constitution supposedly requires. It's an uphill battle. We have over 33,000 North American members, and we hope if you're not a member, you will join us today or check us out at FFRF.org.
Did you know that many African slaves in the United States, as far back as the 18th century, were skeptics and religious doubters? During the second half of today's show, we're going to talk about the many contributions made to society by black non-believers from that time until the present. Our guest will be Dr. Christopher Cameron, author of the book Black Freethinkers, A History of African-American Secularism.
But before that, we're going to tell you what we think about this week's Senate nomination hearings for Judge Amy Coney Barrett to, quote-unquote, replace the irreplaceable Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the U.S. Supreme Court.
This week is the anniversary of the birthday of the singer-songwriter Tom Petty. He was born October 20th, 1950, so he would have been 70 years old. Tom Petty was not religious. He said, "Music is my religion, my nourishment." His song, Playing Dumb, criticizes the Catholic Church. And when he was asked about that song, he explained, "If I was in a club and I found out that there had been generations of people abusing children, and then that club was covering that up, I would quit the club and I wouldn't give them any more money." Listen for some of Tom Petty's music today on the show, including I Won't Back Down, Playing Dumb, and Running Down a Dream.
Our Free Thought Matters TV show this week features U.S. Senator Eleanor Holmes Norton representing the District of Columbia. She is she's a representative. She's not a senator. And although she has no vote on the floor, she has great power and influence and a huge life of activism, and she is a great heroine. And we interviewed her, and you can watch the show already now on our YouTube channel, the Free Thought Playlist.
Free Thought Matters.
Free Thought Matters playlist. But we're going to play a little excerpt. At the very end of our interview, we asked Representative Norton how she can stay so optimistic.
Oh, I find it easy to stay optimistic. Remember, I was born and raised in a city where I had to go to segregated schools. That's no longer the case. I was born and raised in a city that didn't have any rights whatsoever, not even the right to vote locally. I was born and raised in a city that had no rights to have a member of Congress. And here I sit as a member of the House of Representatives. So if you believe in change, then of course you must be optimistic. I believe in change, because I have seen change happen. and because I have helped make change happen in my own city. All of that makes me an eternal optimist.
So we are eternally grateful to her. What a career. You need to watch this to learn more about what she's accomplished at the Free Thought Matters playlist on our YouTube channel. It also airs in 12 cities, and you can find out where at ffrf.org/news. Look for the Free Thought Matters dropdown.
In international news, more evidence that blasphemy is still a serious problem, which we talked about on our show last week. The Freedom From Religion Foundation is condemning the persecution of Yassine Mbarki, reportedly prosecuted by the government of Algeria for inciting atheism, sentenced to 8 to 10 years in prison, fined and found guilty of offending Islam. That's even more severe than what the prosecutors requested. So we are condemning that blasphemy law and such a law at all. Blasphemy, we like to say, is a victimless crime, but unfortunately, those laws are still victimizing all too many freethinkers, atheists, and religious minorities around the world.
Yeah, we've got a chock full show, so we can't get into all the news that FFRF made this week. You can go to our news link, ffrf.org/news, to see all those press releases, but one that we want to call your attention to is that we are condemning an appeal by an assortment of church groups to Congress urging a drastic increase in the amount of taxpayer funds for church security. Currently, the nonprofit security grant program provides $90 million supposedly to nonprofit groups, but the vast majority are churches. And the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, who are very greedy, and 10 other religious organizations are urging to expand this allocation fourfold to $360 million of taxpayer support. We have no accountability. They got huge amounts of PPP money, and it's $7 billion in taxpayer funds on that. So it's wrong, and we protested it. And we also are protesting Catholicism's spiritual blackmail right now. Here in Madison, Wisconsin, Catholics are being obliged to attend church. We are the number one hotspot for coronavirus in the world. This is going on all around the country. They're part of lawsuits, and they're also telling people, wink, wink, nod, nod, who to vote for president, vote life. So kind of disgusting to see this kind of spiritual blackmail in trying to influence all the social policy in this country against abortion.
Our legal attorneys have been very, very busy sending letters. We sent a letter to a Missouri school district about a football coach that is violating the Constitution by regularly praying with the athletes. It's Joey Ballard, the head coach for Jasper High School. So we have received complaints from people, and we are writing to the school district to tell the coach to stop breaking the law. And then we are also advising an end to Pennsylvania District Christian Camp collaboration. The Williamsport Area School District has a schedule in which students are required to attend school in person to this Christian camp, which has this goal of introducing campers of all ages to our God and Creator, the Lord Jesus Christ. So Maddie Ziegler, our attorney, wrote a letter to them asking them to stop, demanding that they stop violating this.
Yeah, what this is a partnership where the kids are going to the camp to do some of their online work. And it's completely an indoctrinational camp. So we hope to stop that quickly.
So we're going to take a break here. After the break, we're going to talk about the Senate hearings this week on Judge Amy Coney Barrett's nomination to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court.
And that gets a big boo. And then we will interview Christopher Cameron about his book, Black Freethinkers, A History of African American Secularism.
I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute, where no religious body seeks to impose its will, directly or indirectly, upon the general populace.
Let's restore respect for America's secular roots. Help the Freedom From Religion Foundation defend the wall of separation between state and church. Join us at FFRF.org. Freedom depends on freethinkers. Beware of dogma. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
I'm Dan Barker. Welcome back. This week we've been following the nomination hearing in the Senate of Amy Coney Barrett for the U.S. Supreme Court. And on this week's Ask an Atheist, which is our weekly Facebook Live TV show, which is, becomes a video, we spoke with a member of the church called People of Praise, to which Amy Coney Barrett belongs. We spoke with Coral Thiel, who thinks that it is a cult. And during our interview, which you can watch it on YouTube and on Facebook Live, Annie Laurie asked Coral Thiel about the patriarchy and the sexism in the group People of Praise.
So I read your testimony, and it's all about how the man is the head and the woman must submit.
Well, in the community, I had no rights. I was told that all the decisions for me were made from my husband, who was my head. His head was Ed Brown of Corvallis, Oregon, and then Ed Brown had a head, and it went all the way up in authority, all the way back to South Bend. So I was under correction all the time from my husband. I still had a critical thinking mind in the community, and I asked a lot of questions. I did not agree, and that caused a lot of criticism of me, even calling me mentally ill. But on my second DNC surgery, my doctor, he told me to go home and rest, but I had to go to a women's meeting, our People of Praise women's meetings were every Tuesday night, and I was still weak and bleeding from the surgery, and I said, I need to go home and rest. But my handmaid reported me. When I got home, there was a car running. I was forced in the car and taken to Ed Brown's home, sat in a chair and questioned for hours. I was shamed. I was humiliated. I was told I was poisonous and that I just couldn't cut the mustard in the walk of Jesus Christ. And I just kept begging them that I could go home. In many instances, that's illegal kidnapping. I finally got to go home, and in the morning, my husband was called and was told by the leaders that I was to be shunned. But I could not leave, and I think a lot of people do not understand that, and this is why many cult experts do identify the People of Praise community not as a sect, but as a cult.
Needless to say, we didn't hear about the People of Praise at Amy Coney Barrett's nomination hearing this week because there was an agreement not to bring up religion except by the Republicans who were talking about how many children she had and how faithful she was. But this is the People of Praise group out of South Bend that Amy Coney Barrett belongs to. There was a satellite group in Corvallis that Coral Thiel was a member of. She's changed her name. She's written a book about her experiences. So you can catch that Ask an Atheist on FFRF's YouTube channel, FFRF's Ask an Atheist. So now, we are not pretending that the next summary of what happened at the hearing is comprehensive. We're just picking things that stood out to us or that were representative or particularly interesting to us. And let's listen to Republican Senator Ben Sasse ask Amy Coney Barrett a question.
What are the five freedoms of the First Amendment?
Speech, religion, press, assembly. Speech, press, religion, assembly. I don't know. What am I missing?
Redress or protest.
Okay.
So interesting. She forgot that. Redress your grievances now over this illegitimate confirmation process, please, by phoning your senators to vote no. That number, the switchboard number, is 202-224-3121, 224-3121, or just Google it, and please call.
Talking about the peaceful transition of power in our country, Senator Cory Booker asked Amy Coney Barrett,
do you believe that every president should make a commitment unequivocally and resolutely to the peaceful transfer of power?
To the extent that this is a political controversy right now, as a judge, I want to stay out of it, and I don't want to express a view.
Wow, she doesn't want to express the view that there should be a peaceful transfer of power.
And there were a lot of moments like that that were pretty chilling. And here's a change of pace. Senator Kamala Harris asked,
and do you accept that COVID-19 is infectious?
I think, yes, I do accept that COVID-19 is infectious. That's something of which I feel like, you know, we could say you take judicial notice of. It's an obvious fact, yes.
Do you accept that smoking causes cancer?
I'm not sure exactly where you're going with this, but, you know, the notice that smoking causes...
It's just a question. The question is what it is. You can answer it if you believe yes or no.
Senator Harris, yes, every package of cigarettes warns that smoking causes cancer.
And do you believe that climate change is happening and it's threatening the air we breathe and the water we drink?
Senator, again, I was wondering where you were going with that. You have asked me a series of questions like that are completely uncontroversial, like whether COVID-19 is infectious, whether smoking causes cancer, and then trying to analogize that to eliciting an opinion on me that is a very contentious matter, opinion from me that is on a very contentious matter of public debate. And I will not do that. I will not express a view on a matter of public policy, especially one that is politically controversial, because that's inconsistent with the judicial role, as I have explained.
Thank you, Judge Barrett. And you've made your point clear that you believe it's a debatable point.
So, to quote geophysicist Michael Mann, there's about as much scientific consensus about human-caused climate change as there is about gravity. So this is a very grave situation to hear a response like that. And she got pretty testy with Kamala Harris. Now, let's move to the sort of related to abortion, IVF. This is a Senator Richard Blumenthal asks.
IVF treatment, criminalizing it. Would it be constitutional?
But Senator, I've repeatedly said, as has every other nominee who sat in this seat, that we can't answer questions in the abstract. That would have to be decided in the course of the judicial process. With a case, some legislature would actually have to do that, and then litigants would have to come to court. There would have to be briefs and arguments and consultation with colleagues and opinion writing and consideration of precedent. So an off-the-cuff reaction to that would just circumvent the judicial process.
There you have it. Now, Senator Kamala Harris talked about the so-called Ginsburg rule, which Coney Barrett constantly invoked why she couldn't answer any questions about abortion. This is a longer passage of Kamala Harris sort of summarizing what's wrong with that.
Judge Barrett, several times today, you have quoted Justice Ginsburg's testimony about not making predictions in future cases. However, she was far more forthcoming at her confirmation hearing about the essential rights of women. In 1993, Justice Ginsburg's confirmation hearing shows that she testified that, quote, the decision whether or not to bear a child is central to a woman's life, to her well-being and dignity. It is a decision she must make for herself. When government controls that decision, for her, she is being treated as less than a fully adult human responsible for her own choices. Then Judge Ginsburg went on to say, quote, it is essential to women's equality with man that she be the decision maker, that her choice be controlling. If you impose restraints that impede her choice, you are disadvantaging her because of her sex, unquote. Now, Justice Ginsburg did not tell the committee how she would vote in any particular case, but she did freely discuss how she viewed a woman's right to choose. But Judge Barrett, your record clearly shows you hold a different view. In 2006, you signed your name to an advertisement published in the South Bend Tribune. It described Roe v. Wade as, quote, an exercise of raw judicial power, and called for putting, quote, an end to the barbaric legacy of Roe v. Wade. You signed a similar ad in 2013 that described Roe as, quote, infamous, and expressed opposition to abortion. Also in 2013, you wrote an article about Supreme Court precedent in which you excluded Roe from a list of well-settled cases that you said, quote, no justice would overrule even if she disagreed, suggesting, of course, that you believe Roe is susceptible to being overturned. On the 40th anniversary of Roe, you delivered a speech in which you said that the court's recognition of the right to choose was, quote, created through judicial fiat rather than grounded in the Constitution. And during your tenure on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeal, you have been willing to reconsider abortion restrictions that other Republican-appointed judges found unconstitutional. As the Senate considers filling the seat of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was straightforward enough in her confirmation hearing to say that the right to choose is, quote, essential to woman's equality, unquote. I would suggest that we not pretend that we don't know how this nominee views a woman's right to choose and make her own health care decisions. Mr. Chairman, I ask unanimous consent that the following three documents be entered into the record: a letter opposing Judge Barrett's nomination from the NAACP, a statement opposing Judge Barrett's nomination from the Planned Parenthood Federation of America and Planned Parenthood Action Fund, and a report opposing Judge Barrett's nomination from the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. So let's not make any mistake about it. Allowing President Trump to determine who fills the seat of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a champion for women's rights and a critical vote in so many decisions that have sustained the right to choose, poses a threat to safe and legal abortion in our country. After all, President Trump said that overturning Roe v. Wade will, quote, happen automatically, in my opinion, because I am putting pro-life justices on the court.
Well, there you have it. Now, after all of that was over, Senator Lindsey Graham, who presided over all of it, made these rather strange comments where he said that the most maligned and marginalized people in the world or in the United States are people of color who are conservative and women who are conservative, and that this great wrong is being rectified, history is being made, folks, and telling Barrett that her nomination is a shoo-in, and let's listen to a little bit of that.
And this is history being made, folks. This is the first time in American history that we've nominated a woman who's unashamedly pro-life and embraces her faith without apology, and she's going to the court. Seat at the table is waiting on you.
All I can say is that Senator Feinstein was very correct when she was questioning her during the nomination hearing for the Seventh Circuit appointment that first got her into this, when she said, Amy Coney Barrett, the dogma lives loudly within you.
The only real organized opposition to abortion rights is religious. And so this is all about religion.
And some other things. So that's our kind of little take on the hearings this week. We are in trouble. If you haven't called your senators, please do so. And you can go to our website, our Action Alert website, if you want to find out how you can call other people in citizens in swing states with senators, if you want to help get those calls out.
We're going to take a break. Stay tuned. After the break, we're going to talk with Christopher Cameron, author of Black Freethinkers, A History of African American Secularism. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor. This is Playing Dumb by Tom Petty. We don't want to play dumb.
Hello, this is Janine Garofalo. Are you tired of right-wing politicians who desperately want to impose their religious beliefs on the rest of us? I know I am. That's why I'm asking you to support the Freedom From Religion Foundation. Join the fight and call the Freedom From Religion Foundation toll-free at 1-800-335-4021. That's 1-800-335-4021. Or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation website at ffrf.org. That's www.ffrf.org. Proud to be an atheist, Janine Garofalo.
It ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, they ain't necessarily so. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
The stereotype that all African Americans are deeply religious is based on a lack of historical understanding. There have been many black skeptics, doubters, agnostics, and atheists in America since the early years of our country. Dr. Christopher Cameron has corrected that stereotype. He's an associate professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Charlotte. He's the founder of the African American Intellectual History Society and author of the book to plead our own cause, African Americans in Massachusetts in the making of the anti-slavery movement, and he's a co-editor of New Perspectives on the Black Intellectual Tradition. His newest book is called Black Freethinkers, A History of African American Secularism, which was published by Northwestern University Press.
Dr. Christopher Cameron was the opening guest lecturer on the current speaker series that's called Legacy, The Story of Dissent Throughout the Years, presented by Black Nonbelievers of D.C. and co-sponsored by the American Humanist Association. And Dr. Cameron will be closing out the virtual Zoom series this coming Saturday, October 17th at 2 p.m. Eastern. Attendance is open to all. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I saw your first lecture, and boy, was it packed with information. You have really, just like your book, you have really informed and filled a lot of gaps in our knowledge. Is it true that there's this stereotype that all African Americans are deeply religious? And if not, how do you know that that's not true?
It's certainly true that the stereotype exists, although it has been kind of challenged and complicated recently. But if you look at, you know, Black popular culture, references to Black religiosity are just rife throughout our political culture and throughout film, literature, comedy, and whatnot, right? But, that certainly has come under challenge, I think, recently with exploration of religious skepticism and doubt in shows like Blackish and increasing portrayals of atheists in Black film and in television shows. So, like a lot of stereotypes, it is partially rooted in fact that African Americans statistically do self-identify as the most religious group in the United States, with close to 90% of African Americans affirming belief in God, according to the 2014 Pew Religious Landscape Survey.
But 10% is pretty high. I mean, not that many years ago, that was the overall number of Americans, period, who identified as non-religious. So that's pretty impressive.
One of the things,
the amount of non-believers is growing considerably. Anthony Penn's work has shown that over the past two decades, the number of Black nuns, those who identify as having no religious preference, has doubled roughly in the past couple of decades.
So it's
slow progress. Yeah.
And isn't it true? I mean, this is what we see with the enslavement, conquered races. When you look at Native Americans, when you look at Maoris and New Zealand, that the enslavers or the conquerors use religion as a way to subjugate and to promise pie in the sky. Is that part of it?
Oh, absolutely. Religion provided sort of a very powerful justification for the slave trade from its inception in the 15th and early 16th centuries, right? With slave traders arguing that yes, they might be enslaving the bodies of these Africans and of these native peoples, but they were freeing their souls, right? So it was worth it for these people to be enslaved, to come out of the barbarism of their native and African religions.
I really love your book, Professor Cameron, Black Freethinkers. And for me, there was a real eye-opener early in the book where you point out that way, way back in the early history of our country, there is evidence that some of the slaves, at least, were doubters, were skeptics, were deists. What is some of that evidence?
We have a lot of evidence in slave narratives and in travel accounts of ministers, evangelists, and whatnot going down south and witnessing basically the rise of atheists in slave communities. Also, a lot of slave narratives took great pains to point out the effect of slavery in promoting religious skepticism and in sort of promoting non-belief in Black communities. So we see with the rise of pro-slavery religion, we see with a sort of hypocritical Christian practice, that a lot of slaves simply could not take that leap of faith and believe that there is a just God looking out for them.
So this was a form, actually very painful form of the problem of evil, the argument against the existence
exactly.
of God because of that. And then you also write that there were some slave masters who did not want to convert their slaves to Christianity. Why would that be?
Well, that's sort of an ambivalence that also has its roots in the colonial period. So while religion provided a justification for slavery, at the same time, it was the case that a lot of masters didn't want to convert their slaves because they thought that Christianity would make them kind of saucy, or, you know, they wouldn't be able to kind of govern them and tell them what to do. And there's also a very powerful tie between Christianity and freedom in Western culture. So there's a lot of questions of whether or not you could actually hold a Christian as a slave. Now, early laws in the colonial period put those questions to bed and said very specifically that baptism doesn't alter one's status as a slave. But, you know, codifying something in law versus changing a cultural perception is very different. So there's still this kind of squeamishness about holding Christians as slaves, and hence a lot of masters did not want to convert their slaves. There's also the tie between religion and literacy, right, that if slaves become Christianized and become converted, then you need to teach them to read the Bible, which can be dangerous for a lot of reasons.
And then along came the Second Great Awakening, and this sort of evangelical Protestantism was seen to be attractive to a lot of slaves. Why was that?
In large part because evangelicals downplayed the importance of great book learning and literacy and whatnot. In order to be a good Christian, you didn't necessarily have to be educated. You just had to have a good heart, right? And so that was really powerful. And also evangelicals seemed more open to religious practices that were akin to African styles of worship, right? So expressing your religious feelings and sentiment through shouting, through dance, through your body, rather than some learned discourse from a preacher like you would get in a Congregationalist church or a Presbyterian church.
And then didn't some of them find attractive the idea of Moses and Jesus freeing people from slavery?
Yeah,
well, let my people go, of course.
Yeah, let my people go.
Absolutely, yeah. So things like Psalm 68:31, and, yeah, just the idea of God as an eventual savior, not only of your soul, but of your status as a slave, which, again, is one reason why religion was kind of a double-edged sword, right? And it could be very dangerous from the eyes of the slave masters, as evident with, you know, biblical prophets like Nat Turner rising up and starting rebellions in Virginia in 1831.
So we want to talk about the variety of Black freethinkers in history in the United States, and we just have a couple minutes before the break. Could we have you talk a little bit about William Wells Brown, who was a former slave who, you write, developed a distaste for Christianity?
Yeah, William Wells Brown was enslaved in Missouri in the early to mid-19th century, ended up gaining his freedom, became the first Black novelist and playwright, and, you know, like a number of other slaves, he became an agnostic largely because of his kind of distaste with pro-slavery religion and religious justifications for the institution. And he would sort of explore some of these ideas in various writings, especially ones published after the Civil War. So him, Frederick Douglass, and others, Austin Stewart, show sort of the origins of atheism and agnosticism in slavery, and they give evidence for sort of an alternate origin of American freethought, right? So if we look at a lot of white freethinkers, their ideas stem in large part from religious liberalism and Enlightenment science. For African-American freethinkers, it would often be more their kind of lived reality, right? What Dan was referring to, their sort of witnessing of the problem of evil in their everyday lives.
We're talking with Professor Christopher Cameron about his new book, Black Freethinkers, A History of African American Secularism.
When we come back, Chris, I want to ask you about the person who got called the colored Bob Ingersoll, David S. Sincor. Fun to learn about him, and we'll talk about some of the other, the new Negro Renaissance and how many of them were freethinkers.
I'm Dan Barker with Annie Laurie Gaylor. We'll be right back with more Free Thought Radio.
I'm Steve Pinker. In my book, Enlightenment Now, I show that the world has become a better place as reason has been overcoming superstition and tribalism. But the values of the Enlightenment are under attack. That's why I'm a proud member of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest association of free thinkers working to keep state and church separate. Please join me in supporting the Freedom From Religion Foundation to ensure that our government is driven not by religion, but by reason.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we are talking with Professor Christopher Cameron, author of several books, including most recently the topic of this program, Black Freethinkers, A History of African American Secularism, which goes way back. Farther than people would have imagined.
Up until the current time.
Talking about slavery times, early slavery times, and we're working our way into the later 19th century. Hopefully we'll get into some of the 20th. And before the break, Chris, we were talking about someone known as the colored Bob Ingersoll. Of course, Robert Ingersoll was the most famous white male freethinker in the United States in the 19th
great
century.
Agnostic, yeah.
And so tell us more about David Sincor.
Yeah, so we actually don't know too much about David Sincor's life, but he does appear periodically in the historical record as one of the more outspoken black freethinkers of the late 19th century. Now, he's referred to as the Black Bob Ingersoll because he took, you know, sort of a similar approach in traveling around the country and sort of styling himself as almost, you know, agnostic evangelical, if you will, right? Trying to spread the good news of agnosticism and atheism among African Americans. He was formerly a Baptist preacher, so he had developed sort of his evangelistic style preaching as a Baptist preacher. Became an agnostic, was a freethinker for probably about 10 years. You know, participated in free thought conventions and was recognized in the Truth Seeker as sort of a leading black freethinker. But curiously enough, by the early 20th century, he had returned back to the Christian fold. And
oh, really?
His story is interesting because, you know, shows the fluidity of religious identities, kind of like somebody I talk about in Chapter 4, Eldridge Cleaver, who had become an atheist by reading Tom Paine while he was imprisoned, but then later in his life would become a Catholic, right? So just
that's
like
the opposite
people,
story.
Yeah.
Usually it's a jailhouse conversion.
Yeah, exactly. So,
and, you know,
but yeah, for that 10 years, he was pretty prominent in free thought circles.
Thomas Paine wrote part of The Age of Reason when he was imprisoned in the Bastille, so that only seems, you know, well.
But then other people took up where he left off. You talk about Lord A. Nelson, who was an atheist, he said. Somebody named R.S. King that I've never heard of, talking about ignorant assurances of nature and all that.
Briefly, how about Frederick Douglass? Because I know there's some debate about that, because I think he does. He seemed more like a deist, but he was very critical of religion, wasn't he?
Yeah, he absolutely was. And I refer to him as a free thinker, but I don't necessarily pin him down as an atheist or agnostic, just because throughout his life, he was kind of all over the place religiously. Mm-hmm. And he even says this in his second autobiography, that his opinions have passed from what he refers to as the blackest atheism to the most ardent religious belief, right? But he does say in 1870 at the final meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society that he reserves for himself perfect freedom of thought. He opposed the use of the Bible in public schools as a way to teach literacy. And when asked to thank God for the freedom of the slaves, he said he prefers to thank men and to put his trust in men, because it's only through men's actions that slavery was able to be outlawed eventually.
And of course, he stayed a close friend, a colleague with Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who wrote The Woman's Bible. You know, obviously was very comfortable with that. So, well, we like to claim him. You know, of course, and celebrate his birthday, Valentine's Day, that he adopted for himself as his birthday. So can we talk a little bit about then the New Negro Renaissance, what's known as the New Negro Renaissance, and some of these famous non-believers
in the 20s and 30s?
Yeah, the New Negro Renaissance is an artistic and cultural and literary movement that springs up just after the end of World War One. And it also came in the midst of the Great Migration, where you saw approximately 1.5 million black Southerners migrate from the rural South to the urban North. So it provides really excellent conditions for the rise of black free thought, right? So for the first time, you have people who may have been the only religious skeptic in their small rural Southern town, right? Folks like Zora Neale Hurston, who had grown up in Eatonville, Florida, or Langston Hughes growing up in Joplin, Missouri, you know, where they were sort of the outcast, right? But then they're in Harlem all of a sudden, and they're around other sort of like-minded people who believe or do not believe in some of the same things. So you see a kind of sense of community developing among some of these black atheist writers, and you see atheist, agnostic, and secular themes showing up in the poetry of Langston Hughes and in poems like Song for a Dark Girl, in novels such as Nella Larson's Quicksand, which really the central theme of this is the main character, the protagonist, Helga Crane, sort of sinking in the quicksand of religion and patriarchy in black culture, as well as in autobiographical works. Zora Neale Hurston's Dust Tracks on a Road. She talks about her religious skepticism, as does Hughes in his autobiography, The Big C, which were both published in the early 1940s. So the Harlem Renaissance really helps to kind of bring together a lot of black atheist writers and provide sort of the ideal conditions for them to be able to express their religious skepticism where, you know, they couldn't do so in their home communities.
Could you tell us a little bit about Nella Larson?
Nella Larson was also part of this Great Migration. She had she had grown up in Chicago, moved down south to attend school at Fisk. Then she moved to New York City, ended up taking a job at Tuskegee University, where she worked with Booker T. Washington's wife, and then moved back to New York City and would start to become a writer in the early 1920s. She got her literary debut in the publication that W.B. Du Bois edited, and Du Bois was another free thinker himself,
yes.
Right? So this
yes,
is where we
sure
see
was.
This kind of community building among Harlem Renaissance writers and among black freethinkers. So Quicksand was her first novel, published in 1928, and it's recognized at the time as it was recognized largely as an autobiographical novel. You know, Naxos, the school that Helga Crane works at in the opening pages of the novel, is sort of a composite of Fisk and Tuskegee universities. And the Dean of Women is basically Booker T. Washington's wife, Margaret Murray Washington. The central theme of this book is Helga's sort of dissatisfaction with religion, her disrespect at the hands of white and black ministers. And eventually she has this dramatic conversion experience, marries a revival preacher, moves to Alabama, has four kids in 3 years, and realizes that in converting to Christianity and in accepting the sort of traditional family patriarchal norms of American culture, she's actually ruined her life. So the novel becomes sort of an argument, not only against religion, but against patriarchy, against heteronormativity and ideas of what a proper family can be and whether or not, you know, sort of this normal family will produce happiness for black women.
So we only have a minute left. We went through the show so fast. You end the book with more modern time. Lorraine Hansberry, the playwright who wrote Raising in the Sun, James Baldwin, of course, and Nikki Giovanni. So, so bring us up to date. What about black freethinkers today?
In 30 seconds.
Sure. Well, what we see is basically a doubling of African Americans who identify as non-religious over the past 20 years or so, and we've seen a great institutionalization of black free thought, especially with the creation of Black Nonbelievers Incorporated, founded by Mandisa Thomas. So we see the increasing prominence of atheism among African Americans and increasing importance and acceptance to a greater degree than was the case in the period I explore in my book, which pretty much ends right around the Civil Rights era.
Well, thank you so much, Dr.
Thank you
Cameron.
For taking us through that history. It's
fascinating.
Fascinating, and we're grateful to you for writing it.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
The book is called Black Freethinkers by Christopher Cameron. We also want to thank Buzz Kemper again for producing the show, and we want to thank you listeners in Philadelphia, New Jersey, to WOM in Madison, Wisconsin, to WMUU and WIDEE. In Janesville, Wisconsin, to WADR. In Central Texas, KEOS. In Central Missouri, to KOPN. To WOOL, Black Sheep Radio, in Vermont, New Hampshire. WRFI in Ithaca and Watkins Glen, New York. And, of course, you many podcast listeners, find out more about Free Thought Radio at ffrf.org/radio.
And find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which produces this radio show but does so much more. Works as a state church watchdog, which is never more needed today, and educating the public about Nazism in multiple ways. You can join us at ffrf.org, or you can ask for a sample of our fascinating newspaper, Free Thought Today. We have our Students of Color essay winners in this issue. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker.
I hope someday.